final case of the day is Curtis against the United States.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. As the government appears to concede, the District Court erred in holding that Section 2255's one-year limitations period barred the appellant's habeas petitions as untimely. After the District Court's decision, this Court held in Ashley that initial habeas petitions seeking to apply Apprendi retroactively are timely. Therefore, Ashley required that this Court reject the District Court's reasoning.
Timely as to the question whether Apprendi is retroactive, right?
That's
all that Ashley held.
That's right.
It wasn't taking the next step. I understood your appeal to be about saying not only was it timely, but in fact Apprendi should be regarded under Teague rules or under, you know, Bowsley rules or under some set of rules as retroactive.
Because if Apprendi isn't retroactive, the district judge was right,
sure.
For the wrong reason.
You're absolutely correct, yes. The appeal does present two additional issues. First, whether Apprendi applies retroactively to initial habeas petitions, and second, whether cause exists for the appellant's failure to raise the Apprendi issue at their pre-Apprendi trial.
What is your count of the outcome of the Apprendi retroactivity in other circuits at the moment?
I believe it's 4-0 against us.
I've got actually at least 5. I just wondered whether there were more. The Third Circuit came down.
Oh, right. That's sorry.
The other day. But you think that's all there is? And it's kind of a puzzle that, although courts have been bandying it about, there are only 5 courts that have done it. But
it is surprising, given the number of times you would think that this would come up.
It's a puzzle that the Ninth Circuit hasn't ruled in favor of retroactivity.
Okay. Let me ask you this. The Supreme Court has a number of Apprendi cases before it, at least one of which I don't think has any bearing at all on your case, Ring against Arizona. But do you foresee in your crystal ball that either Cotton or Harris might throw any light on any of the arguments that you're making?
Use the force.
today. You folks don't even know who almost was presiding today.
those cases may give us an idea of just how far the court is going to take Apprendi, and therefore it might give us an idea of whether Apprendi really affects bedrock procedural elements that's been under the watershed exception. Other than that, though, I do not think that the courts are going to be addressing the retroactivity issue.
I don't think retroactivity either. I was wondering if you thought specifically on the argument you presented that it really is, contrary to what this court said in Bjorkman, it really is an element of the offense and thus a substantive matter. I wouldn't dream to guess what you said, but they do have these cases pending.
Sure, right. And I suppose it's conceivable in one of the cases pending from I think there are 2 from the Fourth Circuit, and one pending, there's the question of whether omitting drug quantity from the indictment is a jurisdictional error that requires reversal. Potentially that the court might look at whether it's an element, but I'm just not sure.
Okay.
Speaking about drug amounts, a more mundane question for you, because the attorney for Curtis at the sentencing hearing indicated that he thought that the witnesses were estimating on the high end, but he said, we don't think our numbers are going to get us below 3,000 kilograms anyway, so I don't think this is a dispute that, you know, the guidelines, you know, are guideline relevant. If his attorney is, you know, acknowledging that the testimony involved over 3,000 kilograms, how could we, sitting here, say that no reasonable jury could have found more than 1,000 kilograms?
Well, it certainly is an unfortunate admission, but I don't think that it's absolutely binding here in this court, because the attorney for Curtis he knew that at that point that he was going to be going in front of a judge under the preponderance of the evidence standard. Now, I think perhaps if he had realized that he could have been going to a jury under the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that perhaps he might have thought that he could have gotten under 1,000 kilograms.
There's your explanation for why there aren't more decisions, because a great number of the people in these Apprendi cases, and this may be one of them, wouldn't be helped in the slightest, even if Apprendi were retroactive, because things like the statement to which Judge Rovner just referred are in the record. We have held that harmless error analysis applies to this, and has not infrequently been the case that Apprendi just wasn't gonna help. So the retroactivity issue keeps getting put to one side, because it doesn't matter.
Well, that's right, and if to the effect, if a court actually winds up holding that Apprendi is retroactive, I don't think the sort of sky-falling defense that the government typically puts forward will actually happen, because the prejudice issue is going to have to get through as well. But we do strongly urge the court, if it comes up with the prejudice determination, to remand to the district court, simply because the district court presided over these trials, is very familiar with the case, it's a voluminous record.
And then could the district court call Mr. Curtis's attorney in for that hearing?
I suppose it's possible, but in any event, we contend that Apprendi applies retroactively for two alternative reasons. Our first reason is that Apprendi affects the substantive change in Section 841 by requiring drug quantity to be treated as an element of the offense. Now, we acknowledge that in Bjorkman, a panel of this court rejected United States v. Robinson and other prior panels that had said that drug quantity is an element. But we think that the prior panels had it right and that Bjorkman was incorrectly decided. Not only does Bjorkman conflict with Robinson and the decisions of 10 circuits, but it also conflicts with the Apprendi decision itself, which stated that a fact is an element of the offense if it exposes the defendant to a greater punishment than that authorized by the jury verdict. Well, that's exactly what happened here.
First, if it's an element of the offense, then Apprendi is irrelevant. Right? Something is an element of the offense or not. It wasn't made an element by Apprendi. If it was an element, it was an element before Apprendi, and then we don't have a question of retroactivity of Apprendi. We just have an issue that could have been raised on direct appeal and wasn't.
Well, I think that with regard...
It's not clear how this helps you.
I think that the courts have reinterpreted Section 841 in light of Apprendi, and what they've done is to say basically, well, there's nothing specifically in 841 that says whether a various facts are elements.
Well, aren't you saying this is like Bowsley? I mean, it was the
That's
same
right.
thing. When Bailey was decided, it didn't change 924C. It just meant that some circuits have been reading it the wrong way.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that Apprendi's effect on drug quantity status as an element is a substantive change. And under this court's precedent in Lanier, the addition of an element to a criminal offense is a substantive change requiring retroactive application of the new rule. And so we think the same idea should apply to this case. Our second alternative reason for applying Apprendi retroactively is that we think it comes within the watershed exception to Teague. A new rule fits within the watershed exception if it both improves the accuracy of the criminal conviction and if it alters our understanding of the bedrock procedural elements essential to the fairness of a proceeding. Apprendi improves the accuracy of a criminal trial by shifting the drug quantity determination from judge to jury and by raising the standard of proof from preponderance of the evidence to beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, can it be only the second of those? Because after Gowden and cases following it, judge to jury isn't seen so much as an accuracy point, it's a different point. Preponderance to reasonable doubt, I can see, is a different kind of argument, but I don't know that the decision-maker identity matters so much.
I think you have a good point. I think, though, in combination, those factors are sufficient to meet the accuracy prong, Your Honor. Now, with regard to the second prong, we think that the Apprendi court itself suggested that its rule would meet the second requirement to the watershed exception. The majority stated that the case presented constitutional protections of surpassing importance. And similarly, the dissent stated that the majority's holding will surely be remembered as a watershed change in the constitutional law. Now, that Apprendi alters our understanding of bedrock procedural elements is further demonstrated by the five circuits that have retroactively applied Cage, which held I know I'm eating into my rebuttal time, but I think I'll quickly speed up, which held that the jury instructions at issue allow the jury to convict on a lower standard of proof than beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, if Cage should be applied retroactively, then we think Apprendi should be as well, because Cage merely clarified the meaning of reasonable doubt, whereas here we're changing the standard entirely. Now, because we did not raise the issue at our trials in 93 and 94, to get relief, we need the full court to approve the overruling of United States v. Smith, which held that cause does not exist for the failure to raise the Apprendi issue at a pre-Apprendi trial. May I continue?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mr. Murphy.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, I'm Brad Murphy, an assistant U.S. attorney from Peoria. I do not have any crystal ball either, but the last time I was here with regard to an Apprendi case, I was asked that question by Judge Ripple, too. What do you see in the crystal ball? And so it's my perception that Apprendi must not be a watershed ruling if everybody's still trying to guess after this lengthy period of time what it really says, how it really is going to play out. This decision should not be applied retroactively. It's not a substantive change in the law. The defense argument relies totally on this assumption that it made drug quantity an element. This court has said that's not so. So have other circuits, particularly...
Of course, he has appropriately recognized what this court has said and invoked the procedure for us to reconsider it. Plus, I assume, preserved his right to take it to the Supreme Court if we choose not to. So, I mean, the argument is before us in that sense.
Right, and as we all know...
Of course, the Bjorkman is itself pending before the Supreme Court, being held for the decision in Cotton.
Yeah. Those other circuits suggest strongly that Apprendi, in its true effect, does nothing more than dictate a fact-finding procedure, a change in that. Also, as a rule of procedural criminal law, it does not fall into either of the Teague exceptions, and I want to point out that here at the outset, that there's some question in my mind whether this particular argument was preserved in the district court.
Before you get into that, though, I mean, how do you explain the Supreme Court's own characterization of Apprendi? Was this just a lot of florid writing on their part? Or
are you referring to Justice O'Connor's?
Well, I'm referring both to the majority, referring to what a momentous thing it was doing, and the dissent. And I have to say, it's not all that common that you see the flood of cases. Apprendi, of course, itself wasn't even about drugs. No one had thought that the Jones principle or the other cases before in that line had applied to 841. Then after Apprendi, we all said, well, I guess it does. But now the court is following up on clearly a real sea change to clarify what exactly has happened. So are we to disregard the court's own characterization of this opinion?
Disregard, no, but three comments, if I may. First is that there's language in Apprendi that I can't square with language from Teague, particularly as to how narrow these exceptions are supposed to be.
And, of course, Apprendi is not only a later case, but an opinion of the court, and mm-hmm. Teague was a split opinion. So why don't we go with Apprendi?
There's also language I cannot square with the extensive note in Tyler versus Kane talking about exceptions. And my third response is, I don't know.
Okay.
What was the third response in answer to?
It's awfully hard. I mean, what I'm worried about is that we're playing games with words like element or factor or consideration or any number of things the thesaurus might tell you to look to, whereas the message the Supreme Court seemed to be telling us in Apprendi was when the offense statutory maximum, I won't even get into these cases that are talking about minima at this point, but when the offense statutory maximum is affected by proving another thing about a person, whether it's that he carried a gun or he has a certain quantity of drugs or whatever it may be, there have been a number of different applications. That thing is important enough to be in the indictment, to be submitted to the jury, and to have the reasonable doubt standard. If it's all that important, then why isn't that something that we should apply in these initial collateral attacks?
Because the rules that we have that apply to initial collateral attacks are that the rule has to have an effect both upon the accuracy of the proceedings.
And you don't think the reasonable doubt standard does? Winship thought it did.
However, when you're talking about instructional error, such as here, the line of Godin and our Nance case would suggest that's not structural error, and if it's not structural error, how can it be said to be so fundamental to fairness?
Well, because I suppose the question is, are you going to give people a shot at the plain error standard? I agree with you, it's not structural error. We said that in Nance. I don't think, you know, I think the circuits are unanimous about that. But if this is not retroactive, then Mr. Curtis and Mr. Sachs don't even get a chance to show the court that in their particular case, plain error has happened. Now, we all know that's like going through the eye of a needle, but there are a few people who show plain error. And the question is, do we shut them off at the front door, or do we let them walk inside and have an opportunity to show plain error?
That, you're talking now about a matter of degree, because that's what this whole notion of finality has been since Justice Harlan began writing many, many years ago with regard to differences between direct appeals and collateral appeals and how that's all worked now down through T. I would suggest that the balance has to be struck here somewhere with regard to finality, because that's the overriding concern in all of this, I would suggest. And we simply need to know that it's going to be over at some point. And I suggest that this is an occasion in which the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal can say it is over with regard to these two individuals. Mm-hmm. Yes. In addition to suggesting that the counsel's position with regard to the procedural, it being a watershed rule of procedure, doesn't follow, because Apprendi did not say that the criminal justice system was fundamentally flawed prior to its decision. Therefore, it did not affect fundamental fairness. It has to meet both of those. That's what's very clear, and I don't think was made by counsel's argument. It must meet both of those tests with regard to being a watershed rule of criminal procedure. I'd like to close by indicating that the government also believes that these claims are barred both as a matter of cause and prejudice, and that we also indicate in our brief we believe that any instructional error herein was harmless, and would ask you to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you,
Mr. Cain, and we particularly appreciate your willingness and that of your firm to accept the appointment, the assistance you've been both to your client and to the judicial system. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.
Okay.